listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. For 25 years, Alison Bechdel wrote and drew the comic strip Dykes to Watch Out For, a generational, yes, fans are here, a generational chronicle considered, quote, one of the preeminent oeuvres in the comics genre, period. She is also the author of the best-selling Fun Home, a family tragicomic, which she described in a recent lecture as the story of how my closeted gay dad killed himself a few months after I came out to my parents as a lesbian. The book won an Eisner Award, and Time magazine named Fun Home the number one best book of 2006, calling the memoir a masterpiece about two people who live in the same house but different worlds and their mysterious debts to each other. Alison Bechdel began keeping a journal at the age of 10, and she's been archiving her own life and times with words and pictures ever since. She used those 40 years worth of journals in creating her new book, Are You My Mother?, which she'll discuss tonight with LA Times staff writer Deborah Vanken. And I agree with the review in the New York Times that Are You My Mother? Is as complicated, brainy, inventive, and satisfying as the finest prose memoirs. I was deeply moved by this stunning and inventive book, which digs down beneath the strata of dreams and memories to create an immensely powerful portrait of a mother-daughter relationship. In conversation with Alison is Deborah Vanken, who is both a journalist and a graphic novelist. As an LA Times staff writer, she covers arts and culture, entertainment, and nightlife, including books and comics, the art gallery and street art scenes, indie film, pop culture, and you probably read her marvelous reporting on Michael Heiser's giant rock as it made its way from the quarry in Riverside to the campus of LACMA. And in 2011, her graphic novel Posers came out following three teenagers from different corners of L.A. into the underworld of L.A. clubs and Hollywood. And she's now at work on a second graphic novel. And I must say that when I mentioned that Alison Bechdel was coming to Aloud, Deborah's eyes lit up. And thus, please welcome Alison Bechdel and Deborah Vanken. Thank you so much.
You first.
Oh, okay. Hi. Thank you all for coming.
So we're going to start. Alison's going to show some slides from the opening of the book of her mom and do a short reading, and then we'll launch right into it.
I'm actually going to try and explain the book to you a little bit first, because it's a very strange book.
Strange and amazing book.
I've been out talking about it now for like 10 days. I'm on my book tour, and at first I didn't know how to describe the book, like in one sentence. So I've decided if I have to boil it down to one sentence, the book is about subjectivity. It's a memoir. It's a memoir about my mother, but what really interests me is the self and how we come to think of ourselves as selves, I guess because I've had kind of a troubled relationship to my own subjectivity. So I explore this problem by doing a very close reading of my own life, in particular my relationship with my mother, but that's just one strand of the book. But so here's this strand about me and my mother. Like, here we are when I'm 6 weeks old. I write about many different points in my life, when I'm a baby, when I'm a, like, four-year-old. That's at The Sound of Music. As a seven-year-old, here's my mother as a little girl. The book jumps around in time really crazily. Like, here's my mother as a young woman in New York City in the 50s.
And you use photographs in a lot of cases. You recreated photographs of your mom when she was young, and you, the two of you together, and journal entries and newspaper clippings. And
yes.
It's thoroughly documented.
Yes, a little obsessively. Here's a picture of me in New York City in my 20s. Here's my mother at her menial office job in the 50s. Here's me at my menial office job in the 80s. Here's my mom meeting my dad.
This is like a family showing the family album.
Here's me on the phone with my mom when I'm in my 20s. There's a lot of me on the phone with my mother, like, throughout my life.
There's a bit of her disapproving as well. I was going to ask you, she wasn't thrilled about the writing of Fun Home, to say the least. And I was wondering how her acceptance of that project evolved, or did it? I mean,
well,
what does she think?
In a way, that's what this whole new book is about. It's kind of about writing the book about my father. And
it's a book about a book. It's meta.
Yeah.
In that way.
It's so hard to say how she's responded because she doesn't really tell me that stuff. Here's my mom when she's like about my age in her early 50s. Here she is now in a characteristic pose.
Has she read Are You My Mother in its entirety? Do you know?
Yes, she has.
And has she commented and let you know
her,
what she
does? Her entire comment to me about the book is included in the book itself. Toward the end, she says, well, it coheres.
She's a woman of brevity.
That's really all she has said directly to me about the content of the book. She's really psyched about that it's doing well, that I've written a book. She got really mad when I got a bad review. She has this weird, like, she's vicariously happy about the book itself, but doesn't want to talk about the content of the book. So a lot of my book is also about me and my process of writing the book. It's a meta book in that way as well. Here's just a scene from me and my mother in our life now. I wasn't sure I wanted to bring this story up to the present day, but at a certain point it became clear that I would do that. So part of the book is about me and my mom. Another part of the book is about this crazy relationship I had in my 20s, this five-year relationship. I just wanted to have like a sort of forensic look at a relationship. And I, instead of using a more recent one, I used one in my 20s so I could, like, nobody cares anymore if I reveal this information. Like, here's I'll start with the very end of the relationship. This was a very bad night.
Though a few of the old relationships, old girlfriends, were just initialed, I noticed.
Yes.
There were a few whose full names appeared and then a few that were just the initial.
It depends if they played a part in the story or not. Here's the middle of the relationship. Here's the beginning of the relationship.
That's Eloise.
Yes, this is Eloise.
We had a similar relationship start that way. It's all too familiar. That's universal.
Here is like 13 years after the relationship when I'm like hanging out with my ex and the woman she left me for.
And you mentioned in the book, too, that your mom was distant, would be an understatement. When you were 7 years old, she stopped kissing you goodnight. She said, you're too old to be kissed goodnight, right?
Yes.
And that kind of parallel distance that in your own relationships later in life, in a way.
Do you think?
Do you think? It's like a therapy session.
I should
lie down.
Feel
free to turn around and lie down, yeah.
Yes.
I was wondering if you were making parallels to that.
You know, I was kind of letting parallels emerge. I try not to impose interpretations on the work. Interpretation in an analytic sense, as an analyst would do. Like, I want the reader to make their own interpretation. So that's really cool that you made that connection. I like that.
Thank you.
Another strand of the book is Virginia Woolf's work. I got obsessed with this passage from her memoir about how she got her mother out of her system by writing to the Lighthouse. So I got very interested in my project in trying to sort out the material of Virginia Woolf's life and how it worked its way into her fiction. Here's a manuscript page of To the Lighthouse. Here's a hand-lettered, like, typeset page from the book.
And for anyone who hasn't read the book, she excerpts in everybody from Virginia Woolf to seminal feminists like Adrienne Rich and psychoanalysts like Freud and Donald Winnicott, and even Dr. Seuss factors in. So it's quite meta and dense in a wonderful way.
Virginia Woolf actually sort of makes a cameo. And yeah, I got really obsessed with the work of the psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott. So this is another strand of the book, his work and his ideas about what happens between the mother and the baby in the earliest days. And then I read about his life, and he was such an interesting character that he worked his way into my story.
He appears. Is it true? I was wondering that your cat is named Donald.
Yes.
Is it after?
Yes.
After Winnicott.
Actually, I named my cat Dr. Winnicott, but that started to seem too formal. So.
I had a cat named Habeas Corpus when I was growing up. My mom was a judge, so that was really hard to pronounce when we were like 5 years old. But anyway.
So I talk about Donald Winnicott's life. Here he is in his own analysis with James Strachey. Here he is as an old guy analyzing a child. He was married for a long time to a woman with whom he had a celibate relationship, but then in middle age he met this other woman, Claire, during the war. They were both working with the kids who got evacuated from London and sent to the countryside. She was a social worker and he was like the doctor. And they started having an affair, and he had sex for the first time when he was 48, which I think is so cool. And it coincided with this great burst of creativity in his work. His work like really came to fruition at this time.
Sex will do that to your body of work.
Here he is as an old man. Here he is dead. I, for some reason, felt compelled to draw this scene where he died. Another strand of the book is my own experiences in therapy. This is my first therapist. This is my current therapist. Actually, this is when I first started seeing her, when I was like 40, 11 years ago.
And do you ever worry, like Virginia Woolf in To the Lighthouse, when she wrote about her mom, she kind of laid those demons to rest. Do you worry that if you resolve all your issues, you won't have anything left to write about? Because there's a scene in there where Virginia Woolf talks about that in your book.
I have plenty more problems to work out. I've saved a lot of stuff up. Over the years, I started lying down as my therapist turned into an analyst. I started like lying down on the couch. There's a point in the book where I revisit my first therapist 10 years after I last saw her. I'm not quite sure why I put that slide there. Anyhow, that's just to give a sense of the different like strands that go into this strange book.
And the book is about so many things. I mean, it's ultimately, it feels like it's a search for self-discovery. It's it's a book, a search for the self. It's a mother-daughter story, a deeply personal mother-daughter story. But it's also about creative expression, being a writer, sexual expression, psychoanalysis, the therapy process, and feminism. It's about so many things. I just wanted to say that.
No, that's good. That's a good summary.
I was wondering also, like, though, when you sat down to write the book, were you trying to weave all of this together? Did you have kind of an outline or a game plan, or did all of this emerge and kind of unfurl as you were discovering it yourself and writing the book?
It did not unfurl. It was like I had to like dig it out of a deep, dark pit. It was very... It just took a long time. It was really hard. It did not come easily.
How long?
I didn't know what I was doing. It took me 6 years. It took me like 3 years longer than I told my publisher it would take me.
That's crazy. Well, the book is, it's amazing. It's it's a lot about mirroring. The idea of mirroring factors in throughout the whole book. The therapist, Donald Winnicott, there's the whole theory of the good enough mother and mirroring the, baby back to itself. But it's also, a search for, you looking for yourself and reflecting the self back at you, at your mom, at the world. I was wondering if the process of writing this book kind of has more accurately reflected you back to your mom, and she sees you really for who you are, or does she not get it still, or not get you?
I don't know. I mean, she might on some level get it, but she doesn't. I've had no, like, big, happy reunion reconciliation with her about it. We don't really talk about it. It's sort of our agreement. I think what makes me really happy is just that she's happy about the book being in the world, and that she seems to take this vicarious pleasure in it. That feels huge. I don't need her to say, "Oh, I loved what you said in the book," because she's never going to say that. And I did say some disturbing things in the book as well. Like, it's sort of, it's kind of a harsh critique of her. So I can't really expect too much of her.
Yeah. Well, you had wanted to read from the opening of the book. Did you still want to do that, or we can?
It'll take like 5 minutes.
Go for it.
I'm going to just read you the very start of the book.
Just want to make sure you didn't forget.
No. Just trying to be all organic. I'm going to start reading just the beginning of the first chapter, The Ordinary Devoted Mother. While engaged in some sort of home improvement project, I inadvertently block my exit from a dank cellar. I start to panic. The only way out is to squeeze through the small, spidery window. I walk along the brook, looking for a place to cross. The stepping stones are underwater. The pool is deep and murky. It's warm out. I'm not wearing anything I need to worry about getting wet. I have some concern about the dirty water, but this only slightly diminishes a sublime feeling of surrender. This story begins when I began to tell another story. I had the dream about the brook right before I told my mother I was writing a memoir about my father. The emotion of the dream stuck with me for days. I had gotten myself out of a dead place and plunged with blind trust into a vital, sensuous one. It had some practice in telling my mother difficult things. I felt kind of like I did 20 years earlier when I was preparing to tell her I was a lesbian. And kind of like I did 5 years before that, as I was working up the courage to tell her I'd gotten my first period. That had taken me 6 months. This story, a memoir about my mother, could just as well begin with either of those scenes. But as I consider moving the beginning further back in time, before the coming out, before the first period, I see that perhaps the real problem with this memoir about my mother is that it has no beginning. Sort of like how I'd understood human reproduction as a child. I was an egg inside my mother when she was still an egg inside her mother, and so forth and so on. A dizzying, infinite regress. There's a certain relief in knowing that I am a terminus. Even if I'd ever had the slightest urge to reproduce, it's too late now. I'm running out of eggs. My clockwork-like menstrual cycle skipped its first beat the very week in my 45th year that I sat down to begin writing about my mother. Of course, the point at which I began to write the story is not the same as the point at which the story begins. You can't live and write at the same time. I recovered and sped up to get the truck's license plate number. It had been a Stroman Sunbeam bread truck that killed my father, that my father likely jumped in front of. After such a curiously literal and figurative brush with death, telling my mother about the book loomed rather smaller, and a few days later, returning with her from a string of errands, I did it. On the whole, it went as well as I could have hoped. Mom's boyfriend, Bob, came over for dinner that night. Bob is a retired psychiatrist. He had some insight into my Brook dream. This is one of my difficulties now, my fear that Mom will find this memoir about her angry. Another difficulty is the fact that the story of my mother and me is unfolding even as I write it. Yet another difficulty is the fact that my mother considers memoir a suspect genre. This adds a confusing observer effect to the whole process. Indeed, my foremost difficulty is the extent to which I have internalized my mother's critical faculties. As of this moment, I've been struggling for 4 years with the writing of this book, this memoir about my mother. I talk to her almost every day. That is, I call, she talks, I listen. That's our pattern. I must confess that I have taken to transcribing what she says. I don't think she knows that I'm doing it, which makes it a bit unethical. But I want to capture her voice, her precise wording, her deadpan humor. I don't think I could possibly recreate it on my own. I'm trying so hard to get down what she's saying that I'm not really listening properly. I would have more scruples about this, I like to think, if I didn't suspect that she was not so much talking to me as drafting her own daily journal entry out loud. My mother has always kept a journal. She insists this is just a record of things she's done, of external as opposed to internal experience. I share her compulsion for keeping track of life. My mother logs her daily activities in her journal, and every day she reads another journal, the New York Times. Not online, the newsprint, the thing itself. I often think of this passage from Virginia Woolf's diary. What a disgraceful lapse, nothing added to my disquisition, and life allowed to waste like a tap left running, 11 days unrecorded. I started my own diary as a child, and when a spell of obsessive compulsive disorder made my entries too time-consuming, my mother sat on my bed and took dictation. Getting her undivided attention was a rare treat. It felt miraculous, actually, like persuading a hummingbird to perch on your finger. She was listening to me. Whatever I said, she wrote down. I found this calming, composing. My mother composed me as I now compose her. The running tap of her life flows through my fingers.
Oh, yeah. I find that so poignant, that last.
Thank you.
I love the opening because it not only touches on the universal mother-daughter tug or friction that's so familiar, but it very much illustrates the struggle of all memoirists, I think, which is how you hang on to your artistic integrity and tell the story that you want and need to tell while still protecting the privacy and the feelings of the people close to you.
Especially if they're going to be reading it.
Especially if they're alive, which is my question, which is how different was the process of writing your two books? Because when you wrote Fun Home, your dad had been, a memoir about your dad, he'd been dead for many years. When you wrote this book, your mom was not only alive and well and active in your life, but a writer and a critical one at that. Did that inhibit you at all? How different was that? Were they equally torturous? Or?
I thought the dad book was hard, but it was a walk in the park compared to the mom book. I mean, actually, the hardest part about the dad book was telling my mother I was writing it. It was very freeing to know that my father wouldn't see it and couldn't be hurt by anything that I said. And, you know, in a weird way, that's what the whole book about my mother, this new memoir, is about, that process of negotiating that with her.
So it was a lot harder for that reason, in that sense. I mean, how present was she? You talk about in the book at one point sort of self-doubt paralyzing you while you were writing pages, and I think that's universal to all writers, myself included. But, you know, writing a memoir about someone who's alive and active is it takes that to another level.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, it's still happening, even though I've finished the book, even though she's seen the book now, the book is out in the world, and that's her reactions to that, to her friends reading it. I just talked to her today, and she said she thinks her friends are reading it but not saying anything to her about it.
It's the elephant in all of her rooms where she goes. In a way, you know, both your parents kind of squelched primal desires. Your dad sexually as a closeted gay man, your mom creatively as a poet, a musician and a writer who sort of put aside her creative ambitions for domesticity, and they both kind of lived ahead of the cultural, political waves that might have liberated them.
Yes, but I balk a bit at that idea that my mother was, you know, gave everything up for domesticity, because she really did have a very rich creative life in spite of being married and having three children and having a job as a high school teacher. She studied piano. She was a really gifted pianist. She acted in summer stock theater. She wrote articles for her local paper after she retired. So she found all these amazing ways to express herself. She just didn't do them as her profession.
Well, that's interesting, because there were some panels in the book where you talk about some of her frustrations. I was wondering if, in a way, I was going to ask you how much of your parents' kind of unrealized or unactualized selves, as an outspoken, successful lesbian cartoonist yourself, are you kind of realizing some of their unfulfilled desires in a way?
I feel like my parents like programmed me to go out and do what they didn't do. And part of that meant not having children, you know? Like, I think they both kind of regretted that in some way. So
regretted having kids?
Yeah. Does that seem surprising? Doesn't everyone?
Yeah. I imagine. At one point or another, I'm sure.
But no, I feel like, you know, I'm very aware of this chain of connection with my parents. Like, even though this book is in some ways about my process of separation from my mother, I think we're not, never separate from our parents. We're physically part of our parents and psychically part of our parents, and we're living out their lives. There's no way around that, really. On some level.
I think so. There was a particularly, I thought, moving panel a couple times, actually, in the book. You talk about how being a lesbian saved you. I think you put it, you say lesbianism freed you from sort of having a soft mind, or
I can't remember,
I forget how you
said.
Phrase it.
Can I look at our slides?
Yeah.
Because I think we picked that out as a slide.
I think you said being a lesbian freed you from being compliant to the core. And I was wondering what meant
here.
By that. In what way, if you could elaborate on that.
Oh, there. a big idea of Winnicott's was compliance. He hated the idea of compliance. That's like the worst thing a person can be, is compliant. It like destroys your selfhood in a way. But I was always like a really, really good girl. And I was like the good kid in my family. I never made any trouble, never had any needs. the only time I ever like rebelled at all was when I came out as a lesbian, which is, you know, a pretty big rebellion. At least it used to be. But I feel like that's what saved me from being utterly compliant. If I had been heterosexual, I feel like I just would have, I wouldn't have had to grapple with my body, with like my physical desire, because it wouldn't have been an issue. It would just be like, you know, no problem, just go do it. But because I had to think about that, because I had to think a lot about it, it connected me with my body in a way that freed me. That I think was really life-saving. That's what I'm talking about.
I found that really moving, the different panels in the book. I was going to ask you about your process, because you have a very unique and sort of exhaustive process of creating graphic novels, graphic memoirs. And I mean, you map story with cards, you transcribe conversations, you take photographs to kind of yourself to get body position right. I was wondering if you could tell us about your process.
Yes, I have a little section here about my process. Hang on. Here. This might get a little geeky, so I'll try to be quick. I made a little movie, actually. I write in a program called Adobe Illustrator. So I'm writing in a drawing program. And I have a little template that I can adjust in any manner of ways. This is me, like, turning. I have a standard grid that I can reshape here. I'm turning three tiers of three panels into three small panels over one large panel.
Well, so, do you do this before you have the story mapped out in your head, or?
Yeah, this is how I write. This is how I sit down and write every day.
Oh, wow. Because you're sort of equally a literary memoirist as much as you are a cartoonist. And I was wondering which comes first, the writing or the pictures?
Well, this is a tricky part. I don't know. I don't really know. I have this two-dimensional page which I can start typing on, but in a specific area. So I write in this very physical way. Like, I feel like if you're writing in a word processing program, it's just like one dimension. It's one line of text that's moving from left to right, across the page, to the next page. If you're writing on a two-dimensional field, you're placing things in particular areas. I'm imagining what's going to be in these panels that I'm drawing. I know what the drawings are going to be, even though I'm not drawing.
And so the story that you want to tell is actually unfolding in little chunks inside the panels as you're spreading it on the page.
Yes, like this. And sometimes I'll do little sketches. Sometimes I'll import images from the web or from photographs or books that I have. But this is how I write. Often I'll just describe what's going to be there. Like in that bottom panel, I say, I'm with Mom in her living room. She's holding my manuscript. Like, that's a lot easier to do than drawing it. And then I start sketching really, really roughly. I just print that page out on typing paper and start sketching. Here's some of the posing Deborah was talking about. I know it's, I'm just sitting there at my computer. You would think, of course you can draw that, but I somehow need to pose for it. And the drawings get more and more refined as I do the posing and do other kinds of visual research. Then I get a really nice, tidy, well, that doesn't look tidy, but it actually is, like my pencil sketch, my final pencil in blue pencil so it doesn't scan. Then I ink over that blue line, like so. Then I scan that into Photoshop and fill in the blacks, and then it gets all sharp.
And do you revise the story much as you go? You go back, I mean, because it seems like if you're writing the story, or if you're drawing the story while you're writing it, are you kind of inking your way into a corner, so to speak?
No, that's the whole reason that I do it all, map it out in Illustrator first like that. That's pretty much the story. The drawings can change, but the story can't really change very much because it's so much work to redraw.
Right.
And I don't want to draw myself into a corner. Then spot color in Photoshop, which looks like that on its own. And then I shaded it with watered down ink on a separate piece of paper, scanned that into Photoshop, and then combined all of it. And then combined that with my digital font.
And you do that for every page, every panel, every page. So the final actual book is a work of art, literally. I mean, it's a 200-page work of art.
284-page
work of art. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, I mean, I love how you break the traditional cartooning convention. I mean, you do so many wonderful things. Your characters step off out of the panels. You break the fourth wall. You have charts and graphs and maps. And it actually, I was telling you backstage, when Fun Home came out in 2006, it was a huge influence on me when I wrote my graphic novel a year later, because it sort of broadened my idea of what I could do. And it was so playful and inventive. And I was wondering if you could talk about kind of the pliability of the graphic medium to tell story in a way that straight prose can't.
What I really love about comics is just that I feel like I kind of have ADD. Like I always want to, I'm always thinking three or four things at once. And when I'm writing, I always have three or four different directions I want to go in. And I feel like I actually can go in all those directions in comics. Where are those pictures we talked about?
We have some really good examples of kind of how you do this.
Oh, you're thinking of that chart, right?
The chart, right. Yeah. I think okay, it was page 22 or 26.
Sorry, you guys. Here.
So you're dispensing information to the reader on so many levels. There's, you know, it's not just classic, you know, balloon panel.
Yeah, this
dialogue
is a little crazy. do any of you know Edward Tufte's work? I got very inspired by him. The graphical display of visual information to convey like something really complex in one image is really an interesting challenge. So this is like basically my whole life in one page. it's a chart. It moves through time. There's my age going across the horizontal axis. There's my mother at the top. And then there are the various therapists that I saw during these various periods of my life. and below that are my various girlfriends at the corresponding periods of my life. And overlaying it all, those little narrative boxes are basically kind of a summary of the whole book that I'm writing, and of Winnicott's ideas about the mother and the baby and how that relates to the way we form attachments, not just to adult erotic partners, but to the whole outside world. So I tried to boil it down to one page.
And there's some other really inventive pages. That's Virginia Woolf and Donald Winnicott having a chance encounter in the park.
Yes. This was kind of a big breakthrough after 4 years of being really stuck with the book. I somehow just imagined, I took this sort of little fictional leap and imagined they might very well have like crossed paths one day. And I've tried to figure out how they would do that, like where Winnicott, he went to his analyst on the next square over from where Virginia Woolf lived, so I figured she would be out walking her dog and he would be on his way to therapy.
And there's a, this is one of my favorite spreads, This next spread, this is actually two pages, but that's Dr. Seuss, basically weaving in Dr. Seuss, letters your father wrote to your mother that you recreated.
Quote from Winnicott.
Quote from Donald Winnicott, yeah. So that's definitely not your traditional cartooning style.
No, I guess not. You know what I originally wanted to do with this page was actually copy, just copy the Dr. Seuss pages so that you would turn the page and there would be the actual Dr. Seuss book. But I wasn't allowed to do that legally. So I had to kind of, that, and that's why I put the letters over it. Like I was going to have my cat sitting on the page, or I was trying to figure out how to obscure some of it, and then I realized that the letters were perfect because it was what I was talking about in this.
And you
section.
You have the plexiglass dome in that shot, or
yeah. Well, that whole image is of this plexiglass dome, this creature that lives in a plexiglass dome, which was a short term I had of way that I talked about my mother to my first therapist. I would describe her as being under a plexiglass dome, but I didn't know that I was taking it from Dr. Seuss until I went back and looked at this page.
Yeah, so that's what I was talking about. But I wanted to ask you, back to cartooning, the Dykes to Watch Out For ran for an incredibly long time. It ran in alternative papers around the country from 1983, you drew it, till 2008, so almost 30 years, which
25.
Is... 25 years, okay. Yeah. That's why I'm a writer, not...
It's still a long time.
It's a long time, 25 years. I was wondering, as over those, you know, two decades and a half, how did your, you know, how did it, the political and visual, how did the tone change and the visual face of it and, you know, as the world changed and as you changed personally?
It got very dark. It got very dark and depressing the longer I did it. Well,
That's interesting. Why?
Well, mostly because we went into the Bush years.
Oh.
But also, I don't know, it just got more complex, more intricate, I think. The storylines and the drawings, too. It became more overtly political. In the beginning, it really wasn't. Like, I didn't really talk much about current events, and then it became more of a commentary on current events. It just got more complicated.
I was going to ask you... just about, you know, you recently won the Guggenheim Fellowship, which is quite amazing. And it's a huge thing.
Thank you.
And we don't have that much time left, but we're going to take questions soon. But I wanted to ask you what you're going to, what you plan to do with it. What next?
I'm going to go to Vegas.
That's a great idea. I'll be your plus one.
No, I'm actually going to... I want to write another family memoir, believe it or not.
That's what, where do you go from here? Do you write a book about your brothers or...
I want to write about my brothers.
Really?
Well, I want to write about my whole family. You know, like in the book about my dad, I just really kept it narrowly focused on him. And this book about my mother is very narrowly focused on her. My brothers don't really enter into it. But I'm really interested in families as a system and how everyone... plays a role in the family, how there's this little constellation and people orbiting around each other and strange dyads and triangles. And I would love to be able to write about my whole family. And that would be very difficult. I don't think I could have just done that without practicing two other more straightforward memoirs. And
I wouldn't say straightforward, but yeah, focused, more focused on one person. This would be more of a meta-familial...
But I totally have to talk to my brothers about it. I'm going around in public saying I'm going to do this book, and I have not had a conversation with my family about it.
What do your brothers think of both of your books? Do they?
That is, I'm going to save that for the memoir about them.
Okay.
It's.
I was wondering if they had sort of a wildly different take on your parents, or was it somewhat in sync with your view of things?
It was kind of different. I think my brothers feel like I was a little hard on my father. But they were younger, you know, they hadn't finished idealizing him in a way.
And you do, in the book, you do talk about how your mom treated your brothers differently, which is something that she experienced as a kid with her brothers and her mom.
Yeah, she was all cuddly with them and stuff, but not me.
Post 7 years old.
Yeah. There are very peculiar gender dynamics going on in our family.
So how long do you think, just from a process standpoint, when can we expect, how long does the Guggenheim Fellowship last? How many years can you get out of that?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's hard. You know, if I were writing a normal book, I could like maybe live off of my books, but it's really hard. If it takes you 6 years to write something, you have to scam around a lot. So I don't know. I think it could easily take me 6 more years to write another memoir.
If you... in writing a book over that prolonged period of time, does it become increasingly daunting in the sense that it builds up to be sort of monumental thing? Or
well, this book did. Sorry.
Had you felt, I mean, you got such amazing acclaim with Fun Home. It was Time Magazine's best book of the year. And
well, it was very hard to follow that act. That was, you know, I feel very bad for anyone who has a surprisingly successful first book that they have to then follow up. It's really scary.
Did it inhibit you writing it, or?
Completely. I mean, part of why this book was so hard was the shadow of Fun Home, but, and the other part was my mother. Uh-oh,
I think that's our cue that we should wrap this up for Q&A.
Okay.
That's interesting. Did we get that right? Well, we look forward to the next book.
Okay, I'll see you in 12 years.
In 2000 and whatever, 2000 and whatever that is. We'll be back here in 6 years.
Thanks, you guys. So.
So I guess we're going to take questions now.
I'm sorry I'm pointing away from all you people over here. I'll try and turn a little bit.
Hello. Regarding the ambiguous nature of your father's death, would this book or its predecessor be different if you had confirmation one way on the other, accidental death versus suicide? Would that change you in any way?
Wow. I think if I knew that my father had been accidentally killed, it would have been Fun Home would have been an entirely different book. But I don't know. It's also hypothetical. Who I can't say. That's what happened, and that's what I know. So that's what I wrote. Someone else had their hand up. Oh.
Thank you so much, Alison. This has been really interesting. I wonder, at a certain moment you said that the gender dynamics in a family are very complicated. And I would just love to hear you say more about that, because it was such a big part of Fun Home, sort of dealing with your father's gender issues and his aesthetics that went with this sort of repressed homosexuality, and then your aesthetics coming from being a burgeoning lesbian. And I wonder how those gender dynamics played out differently in relationship to the story, not to your mother, but in the story about your mother. And gender dynamics was such a big part also of Dykes to Watch Out For. So I'd love to hear you say more about that and about drawing gender.
Thank you, Jack. I'm so glad you're here. That's a great question. I hardly know where to start. I mean, I feel like I've always felt like my butchness or masculinity, whatever you would call it, was something that was always there, like from the get-go. But what I learned over the course of this book is that I feel like, in many ways, my masculinity is like a self-defense strategy, that it was a way for me to survive in this weird family where my gay father and my fag hag mother like prized boys over girls for various reasons. Even though my parents both explicitly wanted me to be more feminine, and that would have seemed like an obvious way to please them and win their favor, I knew deeper down that that was a dangerous path. So it's weird because I feel like it goes against everything I've known as a lesbian activist all these years, like to think that my butchness is a construct like that, is something that's just a reaction to my family dynamics. It's kind of disturbing, but I feel like that it really is true. And that's one thing I love about Donald Winnicott, is that he had really crazy, ahead of his time, ideas about gender and sexuality. Like, he saw that what physical sex you were didn't have anything to do with how you identified inside or who you were attracted to. Way before feminism, way before queer theory, he was talking about that stuff.
Could you comment on the use of humor? In Funhouse, I found humor was really integral to the story itself, and sometimes you seem to use it to alleviate the pain that you were discussing, and yet I don't find humor used in the same way in Are You My Mother?
No, this book isn't very funny at all.
And was that a conscious decision or more of a subconscious decision?
It wasn't a conscious decision. I think the funniest parts are like my mother's punchlines. It's a painful story. I mean, the story about my father actually is much more painful. It's tragic. I mean, but somehow the humor came more naturally and easily there. I don't think that book went quite as deep as this book. The humor is more on the surface. But I miss humor. I'm sort of loath to plunge into another family memoir right now after this book. I feel like maybe I'll do something lighter, like some lighter autobiographical comics first.
Is there such a thing? Lighter autobiographical. I felt like there was humor in this book, especially visually. I feel like the way you juxtapose a lot of the images and the comments of your mom.
Yeah, there's definitely funny moments, but it doesn't seem quite as funny.
In a different way than the first book.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much for writing this book. Like, I know you didn't write it for me or anything.
Yes, I did. Aww. I totally wrote it for you.
But yeah, this book, I'm almost done with it, and it's been incredibly therapeutic for me. And I'm not going to talk about myself, just one quick thing. Many years ago, I had a therapist tell me that I was more like a mother to my mom than she was to me. And I was convinced for many years that she'd mixed me up with another patient because I just didn't get it, you know? And this book is like, really, it's like brought me to a new level of understanding of that.
Wow.
So that's like, I'm so grateful that I found this. So I was wondering if you anticipated at all that you'd be like helping some people along their therapeutic path in that way.
No, I didn't know what people were going to make of this book. I think it's really kind of a weird book. But I have been hearing a lot of stuff like that, which makes me very, very happy. So thank you.
I was just wondering what your day-to-day life was while you were writing the book. Like, how many hours were you at the computer? Did you have a day job?
No.
What were those 6 years like?
No, I'm really lucky that this is my job. And I get up. Well, I mean, how much detail do you want?
We want to know everything.
I get up and go to work. I go to my office and I start writing. And I try to do it early in the morning. If I don't get started by like 9 o'clock, I'm useless. And then I just work as long as I am fresh, but usually I work much longer than that, which is totally counterproductive. I try to like stop at 1 or 2, but I always keep going till 3 or 4 and, you know, fuck up everything I just wrote. It's hard to say, you know, there's the writing process when I'm just writing, and then toward the end of the book I was writing and revising and then drawing, and the drawing would, I have to write in the morning but I have to draw at night. Which works out well, because you need to work all day and all night if you're drawing comics. So I would write in the morning, switch over to the drawing, and then draw all night. That's more relaxing, because I can like listen to TV or stuff while I'm drawing. But basically, it's a hugely time-intensive practice, and you shouldn't do it unless you're obsessive-compulsive.
Thank you. I just want to clarify, did you tell your mother before you wrote the books, or after you wrote the books, or while you were writing?
I told her I was writing this book about her in the very early stages of writing it. I had to tell her. I couldn't just do it without telling her. That would be really bad.
So you recommend if someone's going to write, they got to tell them first?
I do. It's awful. It's really hard. Yes.
So you started off your talk by saying that this was about subjectivity. And there's a relationship in your work that I've noticed before, but then today when you were going through your process, I noticed it even more. And this sort of relationship between representation, but also your process of reproduction, and reproduction of original sources, reproduction of yourself. And so I just was wondering if you could speak a little bit about how you see that relationship, or if you do.
I'm sorry. Can you just say that? Like,
no, yeah. Just the relationship between your sort of process of representation and sort of the process of reproduction as your sort of mechanical process.
One more time.
No, I'm just kidding. I'll just say something, and maybe it will answer your question.
I was also wondering about your font, if you want to answer that question.
Oh, let's talk about my font.
Okay.
That's a digital font made of my actual handwriting.
Oh, interesting.
Anyone can do that. No, really, you write out sample letters and give it to someone who puts it into Fontographer and makes you a font.
Did you scan those letters from your father to your mother and then reproduce them font-wise that way, or you recreated them by hand?
No, the handwriting is very difficult to do. I had to copy my father's handwriting, Virginia Woolf's handwriting. I would be a really bad forger because the thing about handwriting is it's you have to capture that brisk flow that people have, and if you're painstakingly trying to copy their exact line, you lose that. So I was always struggling with that. Like, well, we can't see that. When I copied my father's handwriting, I kind of made it loosely like my own handwriting. Virginia Woolf was trickier, but I definitely had to use like a kind of pen like she would have used.
I have a follow-up to that question about comedy or humor and sexuality and gender. So it's about irony and the difference between you and your mother who share a gender loosely and you and your father who share a sexuality loosely. And I always think of, in my life, I always think of gay men as having much more irony about life than I do, and although I appreciate irony a lot. So anyway, I just was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what makes something funny for you within those paradigms or something.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, different styles of humor are very interesting to me. And my humor is not ironic. I don't think. I did a talk about this book at some fancy place with these psychoanalysts there, and one of them said, "Do you intend this ironically? All this material about Winnicott?" And I was like, "Not really. No, it's pretty straight up." But I feel like I don't know. I'm pretty like earnest. I was raised by a gay man. I understand irony. But it's not my particular style. I feel like my humor is just kind of plain and earnest.
I have one question from that someone actually submitted on, I think it was on Facebook. They ask, "Your work has been a big part of the counterculture, and yet you've been published in many mainstream outlets and read by wide audiences. Can you talk about this shift of audience and if it affected your work?"
Oh, God, I'm having such a personality crisis because of this. It's very weird. I spent like 25 years as this marginalized, invisible person, and now my books are selling. I'm selling lots of books and talking to really big audiences. It's really...
Does that challenge your identity as a counterculture, someone on the margins of culture, in a way, or
I'm sorry, what?
It sort of challenges your identity as somebody of the counterculture.
Yeah, like I have to recalibrate somehow. It's just, I'm still in the middle of it. It's a difficult transformation. But it's, I'm very grateful and happy about it. It's just weird.
Okay.
This goes right into my question, which was going to be about the impact of the Academy, actually, on comics and graphic novels. And rather than talk about the impact on your work, because you just said you're still in it, how was it teaching? I believe you did a course with Hillary Schutz.
Yeah, I'm actually doing that right now. I'm teaching a class at the University of Chicago on autobiographical comics. I mean, it's so, who would have thought this? Like, that not only queer stories would become so acceptable in the mainstream, but comic books at the University of Chicago. That's really weird, too. You know, I feel like I became a cartoonist to escape these, you know, the worlds of literary writing and fine art where work is so closely scrutinized, but now comics are closely scrutinized, so it's sort of ironic. But teaching comics is really weird. I'm not doing a very good job at it. I don't know if it can really be taught. Some kids can do it and some kids can't, and I'm trying to figure out how to explain to the ones who can't how to do it, and I don't really know. It's the smartest kids who talk the most in class, the most brilliantly, who seem to have the most trouble making visual stories because they're just so verbal, I think.
Interesting.
Okay.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for speaking tonight.
You're very welcome.
I had a question kind of about, I was surprised when you showed the technique in Illustrator, how like kind of rigid it and like studied the drawings are, because like when you were showing the images from the beginning of the book, like even those facial expressions on you when you were driving your car, they're so they're like Japanese brush paintings. They seem so impulsive, the facial.
Oh man, they're so the opposite of that.
That's what I mean. I mean, it looks like you just, I was thinking maybe she's been doing this for so long, she can just
crank out
these facial expressions.
No, people think so, I just sit down and draw a page.
Yeah.
It's totally not like that.
But I was wondering, do you do like other kind of artwork, like playfully or for fun to let
I should. I really want to do that. I really want to do figure drawing. I want to have like a real drawing practice and not just, basically, I'm like illustrating my own work, and I want to do more just free drawing. Thank you for prompting me.
At the end of that work day that you talked about, and all that free time that you have at the end of it.
Yes.
All right. Well, I guess that's it. If you on your way out, if you want to support the library, there are forms to sign
up
and join.
Thank you all very much.
And thank you for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.